Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm Pastor Tim Westermeyer, Senior Pastor of St. Philip the Deacon, which is privileged to host these community events called the Faith and Life Lecture Series. Welcome to those of you who are here in person, and I also want to welcome those of you who are joining us digitally. Thanks for coming out on a beautiful fall day. I do like to ask at these events if anyone is here for their first Faith and Life event. Is anyone here for their first one? Excellent. Special welcome to you, and again, over here too. Sorry, I didn't mean to miss you. All right. Special welcome to anyone joining us for the first time digitally. I'll say a word about the flow of the evening, and then I'll introduce our speaker for tonight. After he comes up, he'll speak for 40, 45 minutes or so, and after that, there will be a chance for questions. So if you are here in the house, there are two mics, one to my right, one to my left. I'd invite you to come up to one of those and ask your question. If you are at home, you can also submit a question either on the live stream platform where there's a box where you can key in a question and hit send, or you can email a question to the following email address, social@spdlc.org. So that's S-O-C-I-A-L, social@spdlc.org. So for the last 22 and a half, 23 years, we have been hosting these events, which invite Christians from all walks of life to come and talk about how faith informs whatever it is that they do. So we've had artists, we've had authors, we have had professors, we've had historians, we've had scientists, we've had musicians, we've had athletes. And interestingly, we have had another illustrator, although it's been a very long time since we've had one, who's in the very second year of the series. So I'm glad that we're able to have another esteemed illustrator join us again after all of these years. You can read about our speaker in the bio. I always like to lift up, if you've been to these, you know I like to lift up a couple of things off the beaten path. I'll lift up two things about our evening speaker that you may not know about. One will not surprise you, one might. The one that will not surprise you is that for a few years, he served as the designer for the op-ed page of the New York Times, which means, by the way, he did run into David Brooks once, who is the gentleman on the cover of your program tonight, so small world thing. That again, since he's an illustrator and designer, may not surprise you that he did that. Has anyone heard of the movie Princess Bride? Yeah, he was not in it, but on watching it as a young boy, he became fascinated with the art of fencing, and that turned into a 30-year endeavor of fencing and brought him to some pretty high levels. I don't think he'll be talking about that tonight, but it's a fun fact about his life. So we are delighted to have him tonight. Will you help me welcome John Hendricks?
Hey, thank you. Hello? Hi. Oh, it works. Hi. We could talk about fencing all night if you want. I killed it. Hold on. Okay, we're back. Woo. I fenced foil. Anyone know anything about fencing? There's three weapons: saber, épée, foil. No? Is this not? Okay, tell you what, let's move on. Hello. I'm so glad to be here. So, there is nothing on earth more powerful than a story. If you don't believe me, you may wonder why you come to church every week, if you do. Probably because it's a really good story, isn't it? God becoming man, suffering the way that his own creations did in order to save them, that's a pretty good story. And in fact, most of life is basically, may the best story win. Politics, consumerism, advertising, it's all who has the best story. And in fact, we get a choice kind of what door we want to walk through when we encounter those stories. Which door are you going to choose? Well, we'll come back to that, but the first thing you have to know about me is this. I love to draw. Does anyone else here love to draw? Okay, well, you know what? If I had asked this same question when you were all 6 years old, everyone would have raised their hand, right? So I'm here to say, what happened to you? No, I could have said that statement then when I was 6 years old, and I can say it now. And one of the things you may not realize when you are reading a book that has a lot of pictures in it is just how much time an artist has to spend looking at their own work. Like, I have to, this is one page from 224 pages of The Mythmakers that I had to stare at for 6 hours, basically. And it just takes so long to do anything that's good in this world. And drawing it, this is not sped up, by the way. This is just how fast I draw. Even that is just a lot of time. So I'm not going to focus on any one particular book tonight. I'm going to kind of share a lot about my work and hopefully some bigger ideas behind it. If there's one thing I don't like in an artist talk is people just saying, here's a piece I did, here's another one, and here's another one. So I hope you can take away some bigger ideas. But I just want to start with this book about two gentlemen, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And in fact, you may not know this, but when they first met, and they were, of course, you may know they were colleagues. They were in Oxford at the same time, but they were also like bros. They were really good friends. And when they met, the thing that connected them was basically fan art. They loved the Norse myths. And the first time they met, they basically geeked out over Norse mythology. And from that moment, they began a friendship that was centered around a love of art. And fan art actually is a lot of the reason why I'm here today. Because one thing I have learned as a teacher is that we respond to good art by making more good art. And that's what Lewis and Tolkien did, actually. They loved these stories that enchanted them as children. And they just kept saying to one another, even when they were in their 40s, why don't we make stories that make us happy? Like that. Why can't we do that and make some really good fairy stories for grown-ups? So in some ways, my book is not just about them, but it's a love letter to them. It's fan art to Lewis and Tolkien. And you can see it if you read this book. It's all over it. I've picked these two characters, Lion and Wizard. Those are chosen totally at random. Just two characters that help you navigate this story. And, you know, here they encounter a giant spider. That may ring some bells. But I'm going to return to this a little bit more. I want to talk actually for a moment about drawing. Because although I'm an illustrator, really what I love is drawing. And drawing is not what you think it is. I'm here to tell you that drawing is not just a picture that ends up on a sheet of paper, but it's actually thinking made visible. And I want to encourage you that you can be great at drawing without making a great drawing. So if you are sitting in church like I am and have a hard time paying attention to the sermon, it has nothing to do with how good the preaching is. It's just the act of focusing on someone talking. I mean, if I'm honest, I float away, right? But when I'm drawing, when I think in images, that changes everything. And in fact, I share that with C.S. Lewis. We're just the same, me and Professor Lewis. He said, you know, he was criticized by some that Narnia was just this sort of big, intricate plot to convert children. And he wrote about that and said, that's just ludicrous. I could never write a story that way. Because the way he wrote is that he saw images. He saw an image of a fawn carrying a package under a lamppost in the woods. What is that story about? He had to find out. And so he wrote to find out. And this was me at the Kilns in 2019, ruminating upon that lamppost in my sketchbook. There's how that final drawing eventually came out. So one thing a sketchbook teaches you, and I hope you all will start carrying a sketchbook, is that drawing is not really a result. It's really a process. It's being present in the act of making something. That's actually how we best embody the life of a creator. is loving the act of creating, not what comes out of it. And believe me, I have plenty of students who are not happy making anything unless the result is perfect. And that is a recipe for misery. Speaking of recipes, have you read this book? It's called The Supper of the Lamb. Oh, one of my favorite books of all time. Supposedly it's a cookbook, but it's not. It's about the new heavens and the new earth, and also about making things. And one of the things he says in this book is, interest in results will never conquer boredom with process. So I think one thing when we think about God, he seems to love the making. He seems to love and delight in the things that are being made. So my advice to you, if you want to be more like God, is to enjoy the making of things, even if maybe they don't always work out in the end, like mankind. No, we came out all right, thanks to Jesus. But hold on, more on that soon. So I'm going to show you a few pages from my sketchbooks. Again, I'm a big fan of sketchbooks. Sometimes I always carry my sketchbook with me, and sometimes I draw people and buildings. That's probably stuff you would expect in a sketchbook. But as I said earlier, I love to draw in church. Here's a picture of me drawing in church. And that's my wife next to me, who's mortified because the local newspaper, you may wonder, how did they get this photo? Well, the local newspaper wanted to do an interesting story on this strange man who draws during the church service. And I said, this is a body of worship. You need to not be there taking pictures. It's going to be very distracting. And he said, no, this guy, he does like sports photography. He does like fashion, very discreet. And he was not discreet. He set up an entire rig in the church that made the most like... But I did get this picture, so I guess it was fine. So I draw in church during the sermon, and then I color them at home on Sunday afternoons. And I'm going to show you a few of my favorites. This is cheating, really. I just want you to know that I've done this for 20 years, and I'm clicking through some of my favorites from 20 years, because they don't all work. And sometimes they're great, sometimes they're not. But I love taking an approach to drawing in a sketchbook like it's improv. Has anyone done improv? Okay, what's the rule of improv? Do you know?
Yes.
Yeah, you say yes, and then you add something to it. You never like Michael Scott, you never pull out a gun and shoot everyone. You accept the problem and you add to it. And so in many ways, my sketchbook is like that. I just listen to the sermon and I just make some marks. And if they don't work, it's fine. I'll just try again next week. But every once in a while, I get a page that just honestly does something that I can't do in my more composed work. It's like jazz or something. It's like unplannable, and that's part of the magic of it. And in many ways, I sort of look forward to this because it's one of the few things in my practice that can still like truly surprise me in my own work. So at some point, I'm going to collect these in a book. The only problem is they're too weird for church publications, and they're definitely too churchy for normal publications. So if you have a publishing house, come find me. So as I said, I've been drawing a long time. Here's me many moons ago. So that's an award-winning ribbon on that terrible drawing. Now in the background, you may have seen, Garfield. I drew my first memories of drawing is drawing Garfield out of the Sunday funny papers. And in high school, I started drawing my own sort of comics that was a kind of blend of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Star Wars and Inspector Gadget. I forced my friends to buy them. The one memory I have of this, those of you who are older may remember Kinko's. Well, they charged $2 for a color copy then. So the entire book was basically just the cost of the cover being in color. But totally worth it. My dad tried to tell me like this was bad economics, and I'm like, you don't understand anything about art debt. Okay, we're coming to the end of the childhood art section because I just want to tell you this one story. It's important. When I was in high school, I hated writing. I hated it. I was basically traumatized by the 5-paragraph essay. And so now I'm quote unquote an author. That would astonish the 14-year-old me. And this is proof of it. I had to read To Kill a Mockingbird, and I had to write a 5-paragraph report. And I begged the teacher to let me do a creative project instead. And so I designed this board game, which has probably 200x the hours in it that a 5-paragraph essay would. There's like 300 individual cards. There's a rule book. There's a giant game board. And in some ways, this is like, I show this to my students to be like, if you care about what you're making, it doesn't matter how much time you put into it. Like, I wanted to make this, and the writing wasn't writing to me anymore. It was in service of this story, this game, this experience. And in many ways, my sketchbook has always been that through line in my practice. Just whenever I am drawing, it reminds me of that feeling. And I try to capture that in my actual client work, which any of you who have worked like on something that's a hobby and then you turn it into a job, you know how hard it is to sustain like that original love of the thing. So I think in many ways, my illustration practice has been a space that makes connections. I want to suggest that that's what illustration is. If you're thinking like, what is it as a practice? And actually, as I think of this act of illustration as an act of fellowship between two different things, that even in I look at my work, and there's lots of actually examples of literal fellowship. It's actually kind of a theme in my own work. Even my drawing book, Drawing is Magic, is kind of about having fellowship with your sketchbook in a way. And actually the thing on my drawing table right now is the sequel to that book. So pre-order now. That's why I'm here. I'm just grifting off of book sales. Okay, let's take, there's 2 hours to go, okay? Let's go to art school for just a couple minutes, because I think this will help illuminate some other ideas. So there's two things that actually make illustration illustration: words and images together. That's what an illustration is if you had to get a definition of it. And what's funny is you probably can name one American illustrator, maybe two, and one of them is Norman Rockwell, right? And for much of his career, he was not an illustrator. He was a genre painter. He did the cover of the Saturday Evening Post with no prompt, with no text that he was responding to. So that's not to criticize Uncle Norm. It's just kind of interesting. So let's take these two things and imagine words and images. And the magic thing about illustration to me is that the book, the codex, the greatest single piece of human technology ever created, is this kind of space where you can pour words and images together. And when they get into that space, that codex, they don't just do this, right? They don't even do this. They do a third thing, which in art school we call a gestalt, which is another way of saying the whole is more than the sum of the parts. So like a book with illustrations in it is neither 100% words nor 100% images. It's this third thing that I like to think of as in kind of an enchanted intersection. You might say actually that God believes that art is his own secret Elvish. It's a language that can be spoken no other way. And that's the power that art has, to say something that can't be said in another form. Let me do a little showcase of some ways that illustration can be manifest in the world. Because even that phrase illustration in some ways is kind of like limited to what it does. These are some book jackets that I've done. I love doing book jackets. This is a book where I didn't write the interior. I've just been hired to put the art director out of business and do all the typography and do everything on the cover. I don't want the designer touching this at all. I own this book now. Trilogies are really fun. This is an amazing trilogy. If you have young kids that want to read, The Bad Unicorn, Fluff Dragon, and Good Ogre. I get questions too about how my process works. And I send, for book jackets, I'll send an art director a bunch of rough sketches. These are very small. These are called thumbnails. And this is for a book called The Past is Red, which is about when humanity is sort of floating on islands of trash because of global warming, and all the aristocracy has gone to Mars. That's what this book is about. And so I send them this, and they ended up picking this one. And so from there, I'll do a nice tight ink drawing, and then I will color it by hand and use some digital tools. And then eventually, you know, a year later, I get the actual copy of the book in my hand. It's always really exciting. Here's a trilogy of books by Thomas Lennon. He is in the show Reno 911, Lieutenant Dangle. He wrote Night at the Museum. He's like a real Hollywood person. And these books are amazing. Sometimes I do magazines. Those were very popular in the 20th century. You can find them at dentist's offices now. and of course, you know, kids' books. And this was my true love when I began illustration. I wanted to learn how to tell stories for young readers. And eventually that led to a love of the graphic novel for young people and for comics. Those early Garfield comics inspired, and Calvin and Hobbes actually, inspired this book, which is called The Holy Ghost. And if you've ever wondered what the Holy Ghost does during his time off, well, he hangs out with a squirrel and a badger, and they talk theology. I bet you didn't know that. I know the Holy Ghost is not a literal blue ghost, so don't send me an email. I already have dozens of them. Let's read some comics together. Whoa, I love all your artwork. Well, I hate them. Derivative, uninspired, fraudulent, well-crafted, but unremarkable. I may have okay ideas, but they're never great. Oh, well, so why do you keep making so many? Well, I guess not making them is slightly worse than hating them? Incarnation is always painful. Yeah, most of the Holy Ghost is like my own inner monologue in confession. So again, the wonderful thing about illustration is that it has so many different jobs, or it can do so many different things when you're caring about your audience, which is one way to think about the design arts versus gallery arts. Both are valuable, right? They both are important. Artists that are hanging in a gallery care more about expression, and designers, which illustrators are part of, care more about communication and clarity. And just because they're popular or they're in mass media doesn't mean they're any less of a piece of art. In fact, Jillian Tamaki said this, and I think about it all the time. Illustration is powerful precisely because it is commercial. Most people can probably describe their favorite comic, cartoon, album cover, or picture book from childhood, regardless of whether or not they are creative. And that's true. You speak to kids all over the world who've read Garfield. Maybe they've never been in an art museum. So there is a power to illustration in comics that I think is just very unheard of as a major force in the world of changing hearts and minds. This is my book, The Faithful Spy, which is a graphic novel for young people. It's actually written for middle grade. So when I'm writing these books, both Mythmakers and this book, I'm thinking of like a 13-year-old. Specifically, maybe one who's in history class and just like hates every second of it. And in this case, it's about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You probably know of him. He's one of my heroes. And he was a German pastor and theologian who joined a plot to assassinate Hitler. So you can see the challenge of a story like this, especially for a 13-year-old mind. How do I explain how Germany went from the height of cultural power to falling into the arms of a hateful dictator within 15 years on a single spread? Well, I'm going to use imagery, I'm going to use color, and I'm going to use text all together to help tell that story. Oh, and in fact, a lot of adults read these books, and I'm glad, and they come up to me and say, you know what, I actually could never really have explained how Hitler came to power, and this was like kind of helpful. So I see you out there. Because I'm one of you. I want to read books like, I want every book to look like this. So as you can see, the book kind of doesn't know if it's a prose book or if it's a comic. And it's one of the things that I love about this blended language. Every time you turn the page, it's kind of a surprise. There's like something waiting for you at every page turn. And sometimes it's as simple as a visual metaphor, where I take Dietrich and his story and lay it on top of the story of David and Goliath and let the reader make that connection. Sometimes my work is simply retelling a story you've heard a gazillion times. For instance, how do you improve on telling on the words of Jesus? This is always a very bad idea. Do not try to punch up Jesus's words, okay? It is a fool's errand. So I took the project of retelling the story of Jesus, like, what if this was a tall tale? What if you had never heard this story before? And in the story, the person who is unnamed, called the miracle man, every time he speaks, his words, you know, turn into these live action characters that enter the landscape. Much like when I read my first Bible and Jesus got his own color. It was like, how does Jesus get red all to himself? He must be pretty important. Sometimes my books take a historical event and then translate it into something that young people can really comprehend. And this is a picture book about the Christmas truce of 1914, which is really, in my mind, a manifestation of the Holy Spirit on earth. But if you don't know this story, it's incredible. It's 1914 on Christmas Eve, and German and French and Belgian troops all spontaneously decide they don't want to fight, they want to sing Christmas carols and play soccer together. And they do. And they have to replace like entire battalions of people because they're not going to fight with their friends that they were just, you know, having a biscuit with. Sometimes my work is in the category of what's called editorial, and that's working for magazines and newspapers. This was about the fracking crisis in Oklahoma. I worked with Bill Nye on this piece for National Geographic about solar sailing. This is one reason why Europe is better than us. This is what their leading medical journal looks like in Norway. So this was an entire issue about chemotherapy. And so they didn't give me any prompt other than, hey, make an image about chemotherapy. So I created this image of life and death sort of intertwined as you intentionally sort of injure your own body in order to live. And actually, this was just the issue of Christianity Today from July and August about artificial intelligence. I sent them this kind of rough idea of what if we actually did an image of the building a plane while flying it concept, except this time it's being flown by AI and the pilot has actually like hit the ejector button. And sometimes inspiration comes in the most humble place. This was a fireside in a wonderful place I stayed in Scotland over the summer, which directly inspired this piece of a larger poster for the Hutchmoot Conference. Most of my drawings are on paper. I know how to use digital tools, but I just love the feeling of making handmade stuff. And I make a drawing, and then I take fluid acrylics and paint over the top of it. I'm using a ruler so I don't put my hand on top of the previously painted sections. And, you know, this takes a long time. It's very tedious to make art, guys. Everything takes so much longer than you think. And this is after doing it for 20 years. And then it goes away. You send it in the digital interwebs. And the next day, it's in the Wall Street Journal, which still amazes me. Actually, I love, as was said earlier, I worked for the New York Times for 3 years. And one time I was on the subway and I saw one of my illustrations just on the floor being stepped on. And it was such an honor. I was like, I'm part of the like mulch of New York City. So it's so cool about newspapers because it's like so important and everybody's killing themselves to get it out the door. And then the next day it's literally like in a kitty litter box. Like, love it. Sometimes I do advertising. This was for ESPN that became a giant billboard. I had no idea, actually, this was going to happen. Every once in a while, I get to do a thing called reportage, which is a practice of illustration where the illustrator is the reporter. So in this case, the New York Times sent me to Cahokia and asked me to do a piece of on-the-ground reporting where I would write and illustrate in the same space. And that's a practice actually that you see a lot on political campaigns. The New Yorker uses reportage, and more illustrators are doing this as part of their practice. And again, back to fan art, I sometimes just draw things about movies I love, Star Wars. This piece I did was, this one on the left there, I just drew everything from Star Wars I could draw from memory because I had drawn it hundreds of times as a kid. It was for a gallery show, and it was one of my early viral hits. And it was just one of these things that was all over the internet for like 2 weeks. And then like my dreams came true because the Star Wars people actually saw it and they called me. And my first thought was, I'm going to jail. Like, they are gonna sue me into oblivion. And no, they invited me to come out to the D23 con, which is their big Disney con. This was right when the prequels were coming out. And they had this memory wall where people at the con would come by and tell you their favorite Star Wars memory. And then I drew it there next to R2-D2. It was, I'm kind of washed out there. I have a beard too. Oh, there, that's better. When I was doing my Jesus book, I grew out my beard to sort of be in character. But the 12-year-old version of me, this is it. I've peaked. Like, I cannot do anything cooler than this. So we've reached the typography section. This is for you. I just want to point out, many people ask me about all the letters that I draw. And you can see it in my sketchbook a lot. And I just wanted to reflect on that, at how cool letters are when they are drawn, because they do this weird thing where most people, when they see letter forms, they read those first, then they look at the pictures. But when you draw them, you can sometimes invert that, where you force people to see the image first and then read it. And I just love what that does to the experience of the picture plane. That can happen in maps and all sorts of things. And, you know, over 20 years, I've drawn a lot of type. I've drawn a lot of images. And almost always, it comes back to stories that I wanted to tell. And I didn't imagine myself being a Christian illustrator in the sense that I was drawing literally Jesus. When I was in graduate school, I was just interested in making like the best drawings I could. I just wanted to be a professional. And this is an image that's a retelling of the story of Lazarus using the June Carter Cash song, "Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone?" And so I just want to jump into the act of storytelling a little bit here. You can read now the whole book in 30 seconds. It took me 5 years. Please slow down. Don't read it in one night. I had this 10-year-old who bought it and read it in an evening, and I was like, I don't think that's true, first of all. But he's like, when's the next one? And I was like, you're going to be 35 years old. Like, so the act of storytelling and research to me is really an important part of what it means to be an illustrator. It's not just the making of the pictures, but the collaboration with actual real scholars. And though I'm a professor at a university that thinks of itself as being very important, we're the Harvard of the Midwest, WashU, by the way. Did you know that? Everyone calls Harvard the WashU of the East, so I'm sure that makes sense. But I don't think of myself as a scholar. I don't really look at primary sources. I read secondary sources, and I collaborate with them, and I try to make something new out of them. And I don't think that diminishes the scholarship. I actually think it enhances it and changes it. And a way we might think about this is, has anyone read the Ron Chernow biography, Hamilton? Okay, a few hands, yeah. And who has seen Hamilton on? Okay, definitely more, all right. Okay, now if I was to say which one is better, that's not really a fair question, right? That's not what I'm talking about. But I think what's interesting to point out about this is that Hamilton absolutely does something that the scholar does not, and vice versa, right? They are doing something unique that is totally its own thing. And so my own work in this story of Lewis and Tolkien, I hope, is something like that. And I've actually had scholars and people that know a thing or two about Lewis say, I went into this book thinking, like, I'm not going to learn anything new. But what happens when you put pictures alongside of images? Something new happens. It's that enchanted intersection. And they frequently come back and say, this was a different experience. And I really love that. To me, that means I did something right. And if there's one section I want to call your attention to that I am very proud of, it's if you know anything about the story of Lewis and Tolkien, it was this moment on Addison's Walk, September 19th, 1929, that many scholars believe is one of the most important single conversations of the 20th century. I don't know what else is on that list, but like I would love to know. But this is the moment where Hugo Dyson, Tolkien, and Lewis have this conversation where they're having it about, does God exist? And why does Lewis care so much about the Norse mythology when he does not believe in God at this point? And Tolkien wrote about this conversation, Lewis wrote about it, but I had never seen it like actually portrayed. And I wanted to imagine what must it be like to be with these men as they were hammering out these big questions of myth and faith and truth. And this is a passage I'm very proud of. I worked on it a long time. And it culminates in a point where Tolkien says, yeah, well, the reason you love those myths, Lewis, the Norse myths, is because they were pointing to something that would eventually come true in Christ. And the reason those myths existed was so that when the Christ myth happened, you would recognize it and you would say, oh, there it is. There is the thing I have loved my whole life. And of course, that did not convert Lewis immediately. Tolkien did not convert Lewis, otherwise he would have been a Catholic like Tolkien. But that conversation was a little key that opened the door for them to walk through into basically their whole body of work together. There's Lion and Wizard having a pint at Eagle and Child. It's going to be reopened again. I don't know if anyone's following the Eagle and Child saga, but it's been closed for several years. But it'll be reopened soon. I got to visit in 2019 and spend a little time there. Here's another amazing scene that you may not know from their life where they dared each other to write fiction that they would enjoy, and they actually flipped a coin. Heads, that one would get space travel. Tails, the other would get time travel. Well, Lewis got space travel and instantly wrote the space trilogy, infuriating Tolkien, who spent like 2 years on his story called The Lost Road, which was terrible and never worked, and he revised it a million times and eventually discarded it. He did save a little piece of it. At the end of that story, there is a big wave that destroys the main characters. And that became the Numenor myth, if you're a Silmarillion person. But they talked a lot about, in their friendship, this idea of subcreation. So I want to kind of wrap up with talking about this concept. They believed that, and this was all for after this conversation they had, Tolkien believed that the highest form of human art was to create fantasy, to world build, because it imaged God. It sub-created under God. Like, God is the only person who can create from nothing, right? Ex nihilo, from nothing. Now, humans can do that, but only in one circumstance, right? Their imagination, their mind. And so to Tolkien, he believed that this kind of writing and world building was the highest form of human art. And this all comes from this amazing essay that Tolkien wrote called On Fairy Stories, which is tragically underread. And I want to trick 12-year-olds into reading that essay. So I send Lion Wizard on this magical dragon ride where they talk about it a little bit. Writing stories to Tolkien was a holy act, says Wizard. In fact, he felt humanity's desire to take the created order and rearrange it into new worlds was ordained by God. He called it subcreation. We make in our measure and in our derivative mode because we are not only made, but made in the image and likeness of a maker. I love that. It checks out. It's the very first thing we learn about God. The fifth word in the Bible is... Yeah, you got there. In the beginning, God created, right? So in some ways, Tolkien is making the argument, the way we can worship God in the most highest form is to make as he would. When we create, we honor God because we are acting like him. And so my idea for this book came from, of course, the two most popular things that Lewis and Tolkien subcreated was Narnian Middle Earth, but there's this third thing they also subcreated, which is also a bit of a fantasy, actually. When you think about it, all Americans are obsessed with the Inklings because we want to go to the Eagle and Child on a snowy day and get a pint and talk about poetry with our friends. And I'm literally a university professor. And how many times do I do that a week? Like only 6 or 7. No, never. I never do that, right? And in some ways, I wanted to make an illustrated version of that world, the Inklings, and that myth. So if you read that book, and I hope you'll give it a chance, it's basically a myth that is told about Lewis and Tolkien. And so I want to explore one last big word that's really worth it. I hope it enters your lexicon. This was Tolkien's word. The eucatastrophe, and I want you all to use it in a sentence later this week. And those of you who are very smart have already figured out that, like Eucharist, it's a good catastrophe. It's a anti-catastrophe. And Tolkien was obsessed with this. He really loved this feeling in stories. And on his wonderful essay on fairy stories, he writes about this. And that original page I showed you from the beginning, that's what this section was about. So he's talking about the three values in this section that fantasy gives us, that no other thing can give us. Mr. Lyon, the hinge on which all fairy tales turn is a single unification of these three things, escape, consolation, and recovery. Oh my. Tolkien created a beautiful word for this collision, the eucatastrophe. All real fairy tales have it. It's the anti-catastrophe. You've probably felt it in your heart when you've read a story. That moment when all hope is lost, and then without warning, there is a sudden and miraculous grace, never to be counted on to recur. Giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, as poignant as grief. Lion says, oh, the happily ever after. Wizard says, even better, a longing to live forever in joy. It is the universal desire for the greatest of all escapes, an escape from death. And Tolkien believed that fantasy allowed us to experience feelings that we can't really experience this side of the new creation. And of course, he was obsessed with this story element, because to him, the best version, the urtext of the eucatastrophe, is, of course, Easter. To him, it's the greatest eucatastrophe in storytelling history. You have maximum defeat, maximum loss, and then maximum victory. And also a victory that was totally unexpected. And it's funny, actually, if you want to criticize some of Tolkien's writings, it's that there's too many of these. Like, if you read Lord of the Rings, you're like, wait, I thought Gandalf was dead. No, he's back. Oh, I thought Sam and Frodo are dead. No, giant eagles. I thought the Witch King was going to kill Amar. Nope, she whips off her mask and kills. Like, he was obsessed with it, okay? So just give him a break. And as an artist, I just want to point out, too, if you make stuff, if you think about writing, I just want to remind you that they did not know they were famous when they met. They did not have a board of directors. They did not raise money. They did not have a mission statement. They loved stories. And why did they write those? Honestly, they had whole careers. They were in their 40s. They were professors going to curriculum committee meetings. They were not in this for like, I would like to reinvent the 20th century's idea of fantasy literature. They loved writing these stories for one another. And I just think we have to pause and see how remarkable that is. That friendship birthed this thing that has 250 million copies in print. And that is basically an accident. And the case that can be made that I make in the book is that neither of them would have published their works without the other. And I think it's pretty clear as you read their letters, as you see the impact they had on each other's lives, that their art got better in community, which is very different than what most people tell you about artists, that they're loners and they don't want you to talk to them, they'll steal your ideas. And finally, great art is made on a Tuesday afternoon. They were just so normal as human beings, like shockingly normal. Well, because they were British men, they didn't talk about their feelings that much, but they did write a lot of letters. And I want to share a passage of two letters from Tolkien. This is to his son. Friday, April 14th, 1944. I managed to get an hour or two writing and have brought Frodo nearly to the gates of Mordor. Afternoon, lawn mowing. Tuesday, April 18th, 1944. I hope to see C.S.L., Lewis, and Charles Williams tomorrow morning and read my next chapter on the passage of the dead marshes and the approach to the gates of Mordor. The afternoon was squandered on plumbing, stopping overflow and cleaning out fowls, chicken fowls. Don't you want to shout into the past and be like, Tolkien, go write the greatest fantasy novel ever written. Don't unclog your toilet. To me, it's actually extremely comforting. So go out and make some great art on a Tuesday afternoon. So if there's one lesson we can take away is that the book about Tolkien and Lewis is not really about them, but what they were looking for. And for them, it was this feeling of joy. They didn't know where it came from. They wanted to find the source of that joy in those stories that they read. And Lewis says this, when he's telling people how to do literary criticism, how to think about art. And he says, don't make the artist a spectacle, but use them as spectacles. And what he's saying is like, don't obsess about them. See what they were looking at, which is what all art really is basically help me see something as you do. And so I hope when you think about art, when you make art, you use that as encouragement, that we need your art, we need your fan art, and look around. The church needs beauty and goodness and truth. So thank you.
Is that on or off? No, I'm on. Okay. Thank you, John. That was beautiful. So again, you'll have a chance to ask some questions in a minute. Again, if you're at home and you want to email a question, it's social@spdlc.org. We're going to let John rest his voice for just a moment while I make a couple of announcements. And by the way, the first one, I guess, is the next event. So I cannot believe we're already in the middle of November, but we are. So we've got Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's coming up. We'll let you all get through those. And then we'll gather again in February. And you have this indicated in your program tonight. The next event is February 5th, and it'll feature a gentleman named Lee C. Camp. You may not know that name, but among the many things that Lee does is he hosts a podcast called No Small Endeavor. And if you were here last spring to hear David Brooks, it's a slightly longer story than this, but that Brooks's appearance on that podcast is actually what initiated the process to get David Brooks here for this event. So both tonight's speaker and our next speaker are both connected to David Brooks on the cover, which was not planned. Anyway, Lee is coming to talk. I invited him. He said, I'd like to talk about the role of technology One of John's illustrations was about artificial intelligence. I imagine he will touch on that among other things, but it's going to be a wonderful event. So write that down and join us for that. And if you'd like to be alerted to that, go to our website, sign up for our email list, or go to our social media pages and like and subscribe and so forth. Let's see, I want to be sure, as I always do, again, we're in our 23rd of these events. From the very beginning, they have been free and open to the public. That was a really important priority for me as I began the series all those many years ago. So you are all here without charge, thanks to the generosity of many, many people and organizations. Those who let us use their names are listed here. I'll mention just our corporate sponsors, which include Crossroads Financial Group, Savills, Mally Design, Rotation Engineering, Bay Creek Dental, Mastercraft Labels, The Valuation Group, Rapid Packaging, and Productivity Inc., who's been a series sponsor for a long, long time. Many of those supporters are here tonight, either in person or online. Would you join me in thanking them for making these events possible? I also want to say thanks to Jeff Elstad, as always, our guitarist, for pre and intro and outro. So Jeff has been here from the start as well, so will you thank Jeff for his music? And I'm going to end with this, and then we'll let John come up and take some of your questions. One of the questions I get, and I've gotten now for more than two decades, is where do you get the ideas for these speakers? There isn't always a specific story for them, but sometimes there is, and tonight there is one. Last year at some point, one of our members here at St. Philippa Deacon, a gentleman named Chris, who is sitting right there in the front row, stopped by my office to give me this book. Those of you who are part of St. Philippa Deacon will know that it's become a bit of a running joke how much I love C.S. Lewis, because I do. I've been at many of the places that John showed you pictures of. He's one of my favorite authors, perhaps my favorite author. And I saw a book that was an illustrated book about his life and Tolkien's life. And I will confess, I thought, really? And then I read it, and as has happened with many others, and John knows this, I sort of fell in love with it. You do a brilliant job of telling not only his story, but the story of his relationship with Tolkien. So, Chris, I want to say thank you tonight to you for showing this book to me and resulting in having John join. So join us. Will you thank Chris? Relationship, I would say. Speaking of this book, our friends at Subtext Booksellers from St. Paul, an independent local bookseller, are here tonight. They have this volume, as well as John's book on parables and the book on Bonhoeffer. So if you'd like to pick one up afterwards, see them, and I'm sure that John will be happy to inscribe it for you. I think that's all I have to say for now. I'll come back when we're done with the questions to say a final thank you to everyone. But John, if you would come back up, and I do have a handful of questions online already, but maybe should we start with a question from someone here in the house, if someone's willing to get up and go to one of the mics?
How do you discern what ideas or stories are worth dwelling in and investing so much time in?
Wow, that's a great question. If you didn't hear that, how do you know what ideas are worth spending time on? And to me, that is the right question. And I always get the other question, which is, where do you get your ideas? Or do you ever run out of ideas? And the problem you pointed out is the real one. Like, I have so many ideas. Like, but which one is the one I'm going to spend 5 years on, right? Okay, so my only advice there is you cannot do that decision in your head. You have to do the decision on the page. So almost all things in art do not happen the way people imagine. You do not have a genius idea and then you make it on the page. It's the opposite. You begin drawing and then you generate ideas. So actions always lead to ideas more than thoughts, in my experience. So I just try to make little versions of things that explore that idea. So early on in this project, I started drawing little comics of Lion and Wizard. And it just really worked. Like, from the first moment, I was like, there's something here. This is fun. And that leads to then writing a little bit. And then you send that to an editor, and they say, okay, this is working. So it has to be iterative. There's just no way to just know something. And I gotta be honest, it looks so nice when you hold up the book. It looks like I had a great idea and then I just made it. Guys, it's a mess. From the beginning to the end, it's chaos. And every time I finish a book, I'm like, it's a miracle that this exists. So I always tell people, when you're reading a book that you really love, you have to remember that sentence you're reading, when it was being written, the author did not know if this book was any good or not. So like, every book is in the state of like life or death as you're reading that sentence. And eventually they figure it out, they rewrite, they change. But like, man, from the beginning to the end, it's always a struggle.
Hi.
Hi.
I love your book so much.
Oh, thank
you. I want to say to you, don't do anything else. Just spend time doing all the stories.
Okay.
Write some more. Do some more drawing.
Okay.
So with that in mind, do you have any ideas of what your next story might be? And do you have an illustrators group that you share ideas with? Like, you know, a writer's group? Do you have something like that where you bounce ideas off other illustrators?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Great questions. Yeah, I do have a group of people that I trust. Mythmakers is dedicated to two faculty at WashU that are really important to me, my own little inklings. And yes, you need community. Your art always gets better in community. And in terms of what I'm working on next, well, you better enjoy the good feelings for Mythmakers while you can, because my next project is about the Salem witch trials. So, oh, that's good. A little buzz. Yeah, I don't think there's ever been a really great graphic work about it. And one thing that bugs me about stuff that's written for kids about Salem is that it always treats people with religious belief like they're morons. And I want children... One, I've been reading a lot of horror comics, Japanese horror comics, because I want it to be very scary, first of all, because I think Salem was about fear as much as anything else. And I want everyone to know that if you were in Salem in 1692, you would have done the exact same thing that everyone else did. That there was something going on there, a kind of mass psychogenic illness that had misogyny, it had scriptural abuse, it had all these things in it, but it was all motivated by fear. So, you know, come back and ask me in 3 more years what I think about it. But, you know, I'm just at the beginning of that process doing my reading and writing right now.
All right, I'll ask a question from our online viewers. Let's see. I'll choose this one to start. Which artists inspire you or inspire your work?
Oh, man. Okay, which artists inspire me? Wow, where do I even begin? Wow. Well, I mean, first, it's got to be Calvin and Hobbes. I mean, I was so obsessed with them, with Bill Watterson. I read comics as a kid. I would go to the comic book store and read Spider-Man and X-Men, all the superhero stuff. But then I found the graphic novel. I found Mouse by Art Spiegelman, which, you know, it's the only graphic novel to win the Pulitzer Prize. And so it's worth your time. It's an amazing book. And if you want some more like great graphic novels that are superhero-y, you know, the Batman Year One is amazing, The Watchmen. These are sort of like, you know, the Mount Rushmore of graphic novels. But I also love Winsor McCay and Jack Unruh and Jillian Tamaki, who we quoted earlier. So there's so many great comics being made today that there are frankly some people that I just simply can't read because they depress me too much. Like, they're too good is what I mean. Like, I read them and I'm like, I will never make anything like this. I need to go read Calvin and Hobbes again. Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
When you were six, Did you color inside or outside the line?
Yeah, that's a good question. Probably a little of both, yeah. I mean, to me, when I was younger, the accuracy was the most important thing. I wanted to be able to draw something exactly like it looked like. You know, that dragon on the cover of The Hobbit, I wanted to replicate that exactly. And then you get to a stage where it's not enough to just be able to replicate what you see, and you need to fold your imagination back in to your work. Because a six-year-old draws from their imagination almost entirely. And then you get to be 13 and you realize there's other people in the world and you think, oh no, am I bad at drawing? And you stop doing imaginative drawing. And then when I get them in college, I have to remind them that it's not all still lives or drawing from the model anymore. We're gonna draw from our heads. And most great artists do a bit of both.
I'm assuming this question may come from another artist who has experienced this. So this one is, how do you handle people undervaluing your work?
Yeah, oh man. Oh, well, I don't speak to them again, of course. Actually, it's weird to say this, but I think the person who undervalues their work the most is the artist themselves. Artists are just like a head case, really. And much of what I do, well, here, I've got a slide here. Let me pull up. Sadly, this is an extremely common thing. Okay, so let me walk you through this. I made this for my students because this is a universal experience of art making. So over here, you can see I'm getting an idea, and it's the big, beautiful butterfly. And so I climb up the ladder to capture the butterfly. I only see it in my head. And then immediately I fall way down, speaking of the Princess Bride, into the pit of despair. And the pit of despair is where all ideas go to die. Now, this is not skippable. You must go through the pit of despair. And where young artists make a mistake is that they feel like when they have reached the pit, that they feel like their idea was bad. And so what do? They go back to the beginning to try to find a new butterfly. And then they fall into the pit again. And what happens is they then get this data from their own work that's telling them they're bad. I'm not good at this. When in fact, every single artist goes through this point in their work where it does not work. And the only way out is a very long, long path of perseverance, patience, hard work, and normalizing struggle. And then you finally make the final piece, and this is very important. The thing you make is never what you saw in your head. It never is. It can't be. It's impossible. And so this is why if you ask or you tell an artist, like, hey, I love your work, they're like, well, that's nice of you, but it's terrible. Because what they see is the butterfly. But of course, no one else sees that. So you have to actually teach artists to be like, just accept the compliment. Say thank you. That means a lot. You don't have to say, you have no idea what this should have been. So, yes, I have these on my website if you want. But it's funny because I get emails. I made this for artists. But I get emails from scientists, from researchers, from PhD students that this is clearly a human phenomenon. This is not just, you know, the arts. So join me in the pit of despair, won't you?
Okay, I'm going to make this the final question, and after John answers it, I'll come up and I'll have a word of thanks to him. So if you could wait to applaud until I've given him a little something, that'd be great. So this one is a good one to end on. How does God speak to you through or about your art? It's a two-parter. And how do you speak to God or pray in your art?
I get this question a lot. Is it possible to like worship God in making art? And I do think it is possible. There are times when I am ruminating on scripture in the form of text and image where it feels extremely nourishing in a way that is different than just reading the scriptures alone. You know, I'm Reformed, so of course I think of all things in terms of the fallen version and the redeemed version. And I think ambition to make good art is not in and of itself a bad thing. There is a redeemed form of that. And there is, of course, a twisted, more prideful form of it. So I'm always on guard for that and trying to, when I make stuff, be really present with the work and try to enjoy it, try to honor God in the fact that I was made to make things. And, you know, I think all artists struggle with, like, am I any good? Should I be doing this at all? Is this even worth my time? And every artist has gone through seasons where they really doubt that this is a good use of their time and their life. And the more I draw, especially when I'm in church, the more I sort of feel God's pleasure in the way that He made us to make things. So, yeah, I just want to remind you that if you want to make stuff, that's not selfish. It's just, it's not. You're making in the manner in which you were made.
Love it. All right. Thank you all again for coming out. If you're here in the house, thank you for joining us if you are online. And John, I have been looking forward to this night from the moment we booked it. And thanks again, Chris, for getting me in touch with John through the book. And so anyway, we've got a little gift for you to remember the evening.
Oh,
it's a
gorgeous
little granite plaque that says, with thanks to John Hendricks for bringing faith to life.
Oh.
Thank you for being here.
Thank
very grateful.
Thank you. Gorgeous.